From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, we bring together three Black queer organizers to discuss what progress they'd like to see happen in Milwaukee. Then we'll learn about a monologue program for Milwaukee high schoolers and meet the most recent winner.
We have incredible talent here, and what we wanted to focus on was they are the next narrative, and we really, really try to push and honor who they are as people.
Plus, in an all-new Bubbler Talk, we'll learn how a bridge on Milwaukee's lakefront is linked to the Indian Community School.
We are less than 2% of the overall population, so it is difficult to be seen, difficult to be remembered, unless someone actually takes that time to document.
All that's coming up on Lake Effect, but first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us. Milwaukee's Pride Fest kicks off today and runs through the weekend. And while the fest has come a long way to include all of Milwaukee's queer community, some advocates are still looking for more. For this month's group chat, three Black organizers share their thoughts on the fest and the path forward for queer people of color here in Milwaukee.
I am Richard T. Martin, Jr., Executive Director of the Milwaukee LGBT Community Center.
I am the legendary Chad Carroll. I'm also a community health worker as well as a community outreach coordinator.
And my name is Ricardo Nguyen. I am also a legend in Milwaukee's ballroom scene, and I am a community advocate, and I'm also the project director for a community initiative called Empowering Community Action Initiative. I wanted to really bring us together because, one, Richie, I started in this field, public health, because of you and your opportunity. And Chad, when I was in that role, you really helped me advance with my outreach efforts. So, first question, with Pride coming up, what do you wish it was or did better?
I actually wish that it was even more inclusive than what it's, I don't want to say portraying to be or what it's letting off to be. I would love to see a POC stage. Something just as big and just as promoted as the techno stage that highlights just all the things that are cultural that represents us in the LGBT community.
Mm-hmm.
I would actually have to agree. You know, Pride Fest has been around for many, 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 many years. We've seen Pride Fest evolve to what it is today. I think there is more need to focus on creating safe, inclusive spaces for Black people, you know, and people of color, and that really requires a multifaceted approach. Mm-hmm. You know, it requires all of us, including Pride Fest, to be part of this conversation where we're able to focus on fostering open communication.
Yeah.
Representation that starts at the board. What is the board chemistry? What is the board makeup? Implementing inclusive policies and practices. And most of all, we have to get to a place where we are addressing systematic racial disparities.
Mm-hmm.
We have to address the microaggressions.
Yes.
And we have to be open and prepared and okay with having those hard conversations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I often say that LGBTQ is not always Black. As a Black man, I'm Black first. My sexuality isn't even third or fourth on my list, actually, because when I am living in my sexuality, that's behind my closed door. How I show up is gender expression. That doesn't equal my sexuality. But who I choose to love and how I love is often done behind closed doors in my own home. But when I'm showing up in spaces and I'm advocating and this work is being done, I'm still a Black man first. And that alone comes with so many intersections, and there's so many facets about who I am. And that translates to other leaders too. I mean, even people of color.
I think it's important to also highlight the work. all of us collectively has committed to doing this work. The question is, when do we get to do that work? Mm-hmm. And I think we've been thrown off our game, especially behind the shift that we've had to deal with this political landscape that's going on and the chaos around us. Yeah. At some point, we have to get to a place where we're prioritizing mm-hmm. these conversations. And I look forward to us prioritizing those conversations.
Yeah. To that point, what do you feel like are some struggles and lessons learned organizing as a QPLC leader in Milwaukee?
Well, I'll go first. For me, one of the main struggles I was, again, speaking with him earlier about that was support, mm-hmm. especially financial support. There were times we were packing out bars and our houses, well, my house,
they not coming
for events. But when we couldn't get a space, it was times where I was putting my furniture in the backyard and covering it.
To empty out the house.
And have it, so it could be enough room.
With three grills on the front lawn, because I would be the one pulling up with my HIV testing truck to wait for yes. my bride and give out condoms.
Absolutely.
And tests, like in the hood, okay?
Yep. And so at one point they were doing like these cards where we would have to
recruit the card.
Yeah, we were getting like the people that come in through the door, they would pay their fee to get in and they'll sign the card. And I would tear it off and give them the agency's information. And then I'll report back with the agency. So they were collecting all of this data. And in return, they would offer a $50 pick and save card to help out with the next event. And then as we progressed and got into a, you know, a bigger space or whatever, then they started coming with the $250. Mm-hmm. We thought we was doing something then. And so for me, I got to a point or in a space where I was like, well, I need y'all to actually show up so y'all can see what we're doing. Just be present. And maybe that'll change your perspective of like what we need from you. I see a lot of times other people or other leaders were getting the support that I needed. And they were getting the support. They were getting the big money and 10 people showing up to their event.
Mm-hmm. Oh, talk about it.
And I was getting the $250. I'll be grateful. And I had 400 or 500 people at my event. Support is everything to me. If they show up for me, I'm definitely going to show up for you. Mm-hmm. I'm a mobilizer. That's just kind of it for me with that whole situation. Just support is everything.
You know, along the way, there has been organizations that have supported us.
Yes.
And we've had to beg for the opportunity, because when we finally got the opportunity, then we became a focal point. But at what cost? Like, people don't understand there's a cost to pay the visibility.
You know, Kelsey Blackwell, she wrote Why People of Color Need Spaces Without White People, right? And in that article, she says, people of color need their own spaces. Black people need their own spaces. We need places in which we can gather and be free from the mainstream stereotypes and modernizations and marginalizations that premeditate every other societal space we occupy. So when you talk about support, when you talk about what support looks like in doing this work, a lot of times when we create spaces, you have mainframe organizations that have the power, that have the money that we are trying to get some of, but they've ostracized us or they want to micromanage.
Yes.
They want to micromanage how we get to work. Mm-hmm. I need people in my corner. The center needs people in the corner. We need people as we mm-hmm. collectively do this work to break down the systematic barriers and walls that we have been oppressed mm-hmm. and we've been conditioned. And we didn't choose. Let me make it very clear. We didn't choose to take on this oppression.
No, not at all.
And when you have those conversations and when you talk about people like Kelsey Blackwell, who understands it, valuing and protecting spaces for people of color is not just a kind thing that white people can do to help us feel better. Supporting these spaces is crucial to the resistance of oppression that has existed not just for decades, but for centuries. And when you really do a deep dive from a historical perspective, thousands of years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what are you all hopeful for the future of Milwaukee for QPLC individuals?
I'll speak to the leader. I would love to see more collaboration support between the leaders, between the mobilizers. Right now, I feel like we're in a space where everybody feel like they're trying to one-up me. Let me do this. They're trying to one-up me. Let me do that. Instead of working together and making a or having a bigger outcome, everybody's trying to outdo everybody, and nobody's working together for a bigger outcome. So that's what I would like to see, more collaboration, less crab in the barrel.
I think where we are now is setting the tone for what the future of Black gay spaces look like in the city of Milwaukee. I think we have to prepare to have more bolder conversations, more healthy, bolder conversations. Mm-hmm. And so one, I'm hopeful that one day we'll end up in a land of healing. Mm-hmm. Where we will not be oppressed, we will not be ostracized, we will be valued at tables that matter.
Yeah. With that being said, you know, one of the things that I had hoped for was to re-envision Black pride in Milwaukee. And that started pre-COVID under the leadership of Jeff Roman and Richie Martin, where we were organizing, but then COVID happened. And then it fell off, and I said, well, they came to me, was like, oh, you got to make this happen. I'm like, okay. And everybody comes to me, you got to make this happen. I said, girl, I ain't got no time for this. But then I came across Center for Black Equity out of D.C. that houses all of the Black Prides globally. I went to a meeting for a week to learn, and I said, okay, I can make this happen. My network supported us in doing this, and we had a three-day event, and we named it Blacktoberfest because, one, I can't think of any Pride events during the fall and winter. Seasonal depression is real, and depression is real, and so we need things where we can keep people motivated throughout the year. So Blacktoberfest was created to be a three-day celebration centered around economic well-being, wellness, community engagement, and celebration. And so last year was a huge success. We got a proclamation based on not it being pride, but based on the leaders putting into it. And so that was a blessing because that puts us in history. That's the other thing. We don't have a lot of documented Black history, Black gay history. And so that's important because whether Blacktober never happens again, no one can say it didn't happen. Or if they say it happened, there's proof that it happened. And so that has been my hope for Milwaukee as our QPLC community. And I know that there is work that needs to be done. I was just thinking the other day, I need to meet with my trans brothers and sisters and talk more about that and seeing how we can support. But I want to go on record to say that we can't do it all and we shouldn't have to. But you do the best you can with what you have and to fidelity. And that you ensure that you don't cause harm, but that you evoke thought and inspire people to be the best version of themselves each and every day.
That was Ricardo Wynn, Richie T. Martin, and Chad Carroll. Group Chat is our monthly segment featuring local voices and is produced by WUWM's Jimmy Gutierrez. We reached out to Pride Fest about the concerns related to inclusivity, and they did not provide a comment. In about 15 minutes, we'll learn about a Milwaukee bridge and its connection to the Indian Community School. But first, we'll meet a young Milwaukee actor who won a national monologue competition. That's coming up on Lake Effect on WUWM. You're listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. For the second year in a row, the Milwaukee Repertory Theater has earned first place in a national monologue competition. The next narrative monologue competition is a national program for high school students that features the work of contemporary Black playwrights. Silver Anderson is a student at Golda Meir High School and a Milwaukee Rep regional finalist who recently won first place in the national monologue competition. Lake Effect's expert Nunez is joined by Anderson and their Milwaukee rep coach, James Carrington, to learn about the monologue competition. A warning to our listeners, at the end of this conversation, there is a monologue reading that may be upsetting for some, as it includes offensive language and references to self-harm.
James, for people who aren't familiar with the Next Narrative Monologue Competition, can you explain what it is and what role Milwaukee Rep plays in preparing students for it?
Yeah. So the Next Narrative Monologue Competition was started by True Colors Theater in Atlanta, Georgia, about 5 years ago. And True Colors looked at the landscape of theater and said there are not enough or nearly any monologues or work by contemporary Black playwrights. So they commissioned a giant book, a compendium of brand new contemporary monologues from African-American playwrights. But any teenager across the country can participate. So no matter what your race is, if you're in high school, you can use one of these monologues to enter the competition. And these monologues range from topics from class, ableism, gender identity, politics, social and emotional well-being. Any topic, you name it, there's a monologue about it. And Milwaukee Rep is one of the 9 regional partners across the country. And we've been doing it since inception about 4 years ago. Next year will be the 5th year. Mm-hmm. And we enter the competition. And every city is a little bit different. They run their auditions a little bit differently. But we have our top 10 from our audition process. And then we work with them for about 5 weeks. And then at our semifinals, we choose our top 2 and a third runner-up. And then we work some more with them for another 4 weeks. And then we fly, all 4 of us, me and my counterpart, Zach Woods, we fly out to New York and compete. And yeah, we took home the prize again.
Yeah.
This year, 2 years in a row.
I love it. And I understand that you also offer workshops for these students to practice and learn their skills, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I mentioned briefly that we have the workshops / rehearsals with our top 10 cohort and then the top 2 winners and the third runner-up. But before that, we also offer free workshop training in school and after school. We have a partnership with MPS, and we offer free training to basically anybody, not just MPS schools. Like, we work with the South Division and we work with Golden Meir, but also we go to community centers. We can go to churches. We offer free training to get kids ready for the audition. We also have a pre-audition workshop. So Silver has participated in these before, too, that you read the monologues and you choose one. And if you're unsure if it's the right one for you, you can come and present it in front of some of the staff of Milwaukee Repertory Theater, and we'll kind of coach you and guide you on whether that's the right choice. And then once you audition, like I said, we have those 4 free training workshops where you can just keep working on your craft. But yeah, we offer training all year long.
Wow. So I definitely don't see a reason why people should not be signing up.
Exactly.
Silver, as James mentioned, you placed first in this year's competition. Congratulations.
Yeah.
I'm curious, where does your love for performing and storytelling stem from?
I started writing like stories when I want to say when I was in like second grade. But just telling stories is so really very fun. And I think the first time that I saw my sister started acting before I did, and she was in a show, and I was like, I want to do that. And then I didn't. Instead, I went to MISO and I played bass for 1.5 years. My parents would tell you that I played bass for 2 years. I only remember a little bit less than that. But yeah, so acting started to be like an outlet to tell stories in a different way besides just like the words on the page, because sometimes the words off of the page are also very fun and silly and a great time.
So it seems like you've always had some sort of creative upbringing to push you maybe in this trajectory. Walk me through the process of what you did to prepare for this competition.
When I came into it this year, I picked Shame by Cheryl L. West, and I picked that piece because that character is very mean and not nice. And then at the end, she's kind of like, oh, wait, I'm very mean and not nice. And I think I'm a little bit nice sometimes. So I was like, hey, I'm going to try and like stretch myself out as a performer and like see what happens there. And I memorized the piece. And then I, like, looked at it again because when I was, like, learning it, I was struggling because of the location of it. Because a lot of the pieces in that compendium, you either get the person you're talking to or you get the location that you're in. I kind of got a location, and I kind of got a person I was talking to. And that's what we, like, talked about during our pre-audition workshop. I was like, hey, I don't know where I am or who I'm talking to. Because it is more of, like, a counseling session. Like, she's retelling what happened basically to someone. It could be anyone. There were a lot of ideas bouncing around of like how it would affect her, how the other person is like reacting to what she's saying, because it is not kind, not good. She's calling her sister a lot of names and just kind of very removed from the fact that, trigger warning, question mark, but she does talk about like her sister like self-harming and like those kinds of things. And there's just such a level of removal as the character from the situation at hand, and like seeing or imagining that someone else is reacting to this and be like, oh my God, what? Kind of changes the way that that character reacts to what they are saying. And then earning that discovery, or what we were working on throughout the workshops after regionals, was earning that discovery or finding where she kind of like turns the page of like, oh, I can hear what I'm saying and I can hear, and this is horrible. So the biggest part of that journey was basically figuring out, just discovering things, who I'm talking to, where I am. Once that was set, it became, when does she realize that what she's saying is horrible? Because if she's the villain the whole time, we don't get anything from that. We just see this, like, mean person being mean, and then it's over. But if it's, like, a discovery, then there's still a moment of everyone can have empathy for one another without it, I guess, taking away from the situation at hand. So, yeah.
There's dimension. And you were a regional finalist in 2024. What are some of the skills you learned or improved on since going through this program?
The biggest note that I've gotten throughout my entire acting career has been pacing. I talk really fast because I'm a youngest sibling, and I am a number of other things that require me to talk faster than I think other people would, like, do normally. So doing the piece, there are a lot of times where I, like, would speed up and I'd, like, lose certain words or things that would be, like, helpful in the script. So learning how and when to slow down was super important and helpful. And then I think one of the other big things they pushed was the visualization aspect. And I like pride myself, or I like to focus a lot on where I'm looking so that I am more immersed in what is happening. So taking the time in those workshops to, I guess, learn that skill to build and visualize was very helpful.
Yeah, that makes sense. And James, this is the second year in a row that a regional finalist from Milwaukee Rep has won first place at national finals. What would you attribute the success to?
You know, it's funny. People at New York, other representatives and chaperones asked us, they're like, what's going on in Milwaukee? What's in the water in Milwaukee? And besides lead, there is an abundance of talent here. You know, there's Chicago, there's Seattle, there's New York, Atlanta. There's these huge epicenters of theater and talent and Broadway and commercial work. And Milwaukee always kind of flies under the radar. We have incredible talent here. And what Zach and I wanted to focus on, we're the coaches for the monologue competition. What we wanted to focus on was just that. They are the next narrative. What matters to them? And we really, really try to push and honor who they are as people and what they bring to the table. So Silver is already a skilled young actor. You know, they've done a lot of work across the city. And other people don't have that experience. So they're brand new. Rachel last year had no experience really in theater. Mm-hmm. But we want to honor where they are as human beings. And I think we just want to focus on that. Silver wanted to focus on pacing and visualization. Great. Let's work on that. Acting is so subjective. Every person is different. Every student is different. And you just want to meet them where they are and encourage them and let them kind of do their thing and be there to catch them and also be there to back off. When we got to New York, we said to Silver and Thatcher, let us know when we're too much. Let us know if we're pushing you too hard. It's all about you. Because as adults, we learn that not everything is about us, and especially in theater. There's directors, there's stage managers, there's lighting people, there's crew, there's the audience. But right now, we can focus on you. We can focus on the story that you want to tell.
I definitely sense you and your coach partner, Zach, respecting these young actors, these young students, for the craft that they do have or want to build on. And Silver, you mentioned that you performed a monologue piece called Shame by Cheryl West. Why did you specifically choose this one?
I have two reasons. I'll share this one first. My typecast this year has been this omnipotent individual that is like above everything else. I understudied Karnak in Ride the Cyclone, and right before that I played Prospero in The Tempest. But just kind of like thinking of me as an actor and where I kind of like not miss the mark, but areas of my repertoire that are not as shaded in as they could be. So looking through the compendium, I was between Shame and there was a piece called Friends, Ones We Can Depend Upon, because I can kind of pull from the experience that character has, but I didn't want to be me and like do that acting thing this time. I wanted to try and like spread my wings a little bit. And then the other part of it for me was there are a lot of good pieces in there, and there are pieces that are a lot more popular than others, and seeing the talent that comes out of those pieces is always so wonderful and so great. But like seeing different stories be told on either the rep stage or on like the national stage, seeing more pieces done by different people was another aspect of it for me. Like I wanted to do a piece that I hadn't seen win recently. So I was like, this one that I relate to, or this one that could like help me grow as an actor. And then I went the one that'll help me grow, because I'm still growing and will continue to, hopefully. Yeah.
Right. Absolutely. So I'm also curious, what advice do you have for other young aspiring performers?
Well, that's a great question. I think the biggest piece of advice I have is to get up and do it. I face a lot of hesitancy with a lot of the things that I do just because of like anxiety and all that kind of stuff. But I think with acting in certain situations, it is better to get up and try than to sit back and let someone else do it, because your brain would be filled with millions of what-if situations of, oh, what if I did get up there? What if someone saw me? What if someone laughs? You won't know until you get there. And if storytelling in any fashion is the thing that you want to do, it is important to push yourself to tell that story, because otherwise people simply just will not listen to it. And I think that's kind of what we learned with this competition. We didn't have it before because no one was asking for it. You have to push the envelope to be like, hey, there's not enough Black people writing stories or stories that are like open to the public that we can all see all the time. And we need to fix that. So we need to make the effort to go fix that, because unfortunately, that's not just something that just comes along very easily. But yeah, I think the biggest thing is just push yourself to do it and then leap and then look, I think is a great way to put that.
So before we wrap up, I understand you've prepared to perform the winning monologue for us today. But just as a quick warning for our listeners, this next bit might be upsetting for some to listen to, as it includes offensive language and makes references to self-harm. So with that, Silver, whenever you're ready, please go ahead.
Yeah. This is Shame by Cheryl L. West. I shouldn't have seen it. She should have closed the dang door. My teacher had just talked about it. How does shame show up in your life? Later, at breakfast, I tell her, girl, you don't need so much cereal. She answers by throwing some at me. It's disgusting watching her eat, shoveling sugar smacks in her mouth, barely pausing to breathe. Shovel, 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 sugar, sugar, sugar. I wanted to yell, maybe even slap her. I saw you. I saw you this morning. As much as I try not to see you, I can't help but see you. We catch the bus, and as usual, I run ahead, hoping against hope that no one will see me with her. I mumble the usual to the bus driver. Wait. She's coming. I sit way in the back, laughing with my friends, even joining in when they laugh at her. Maybe I laugh the loudest. Fourth period. I see her in the school hallway, her shirt button about to pop, wearing those stupid leggings that make her look like some nasty overstuffed sausage. I see them all laughing, snickering, calling her names. Blubber butt, bugger, fat lard. She passes me. Her eyes plead and her mouth, greasy as always, whispers, I am your sister. Help me. And I pretend not to hear, walk past, trying not to see. I remember that moment so vividly when they pull me out of class to tell me that she cut herself. Razor slashes up her whole arm and all the way down those sausage thighs. And they tell me how the janitor had to use a crowbar to open the stall door to pry her out. That night, racked with grief, our mother screams at me, why didn't you say something? And I stutter, trying to come up with an answer, and I think about what I tried to unsee. My sister in the bathroom that morning, stripped of all her clothes, trying to weigh herself on one leg. A hippopotamus trying to strike a ballerina pose. That's what I thought before. I thought, she's going to break the scale. My mother looks at me, tears running down her face, a look I will never be able to unsee. I'm so ashamed of you. Thank you.
Wow. Oh my gosh. Chills. Silver, thank you so much for sharing your work with me. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
And James, thank you for telling me about this impactful program.
Thank you.
Silver Anderson is a Milwaukee Rep regional finalist who recently won first place at the 2025 Next Narrative Monologue Competition. James Carrington is Milwaukee Rep's Associate Director of Engagement and one of Anderson's monologue coaches. They both spoke with Lake Effect's Exgrit Nunez. In 2021, Bubbler Talk investigated a bridge near the Milwaukee River that seems to go nowhere. But there's another bridge in Milwaukee that also seems to go nowhere that a WUWM listener wanted to know about. Here's WUWM's Mayon Silver with an extended Bubbler Talk that kicks off the new season.
Bubbler Talk, quenching Milwaukee's thirst for knowledge.
I'm WUWM's Mayon Silver. I'm standing at the shore of Lake Michigan, near the McKinley Marina in Milwaukee. In front of me is a 106-foot-long white bridge.
Yeah, I called it the bridge to nowhere because it just kind of seems to go, you know, over a little piece of water that you could easily just walk around. So I didn't really know if it had a purpose or why it was there.
Eileen McEnroe-Hankus is a structural engineer in Milwaukee. She says there doesn't appear to be a functional reason for the bridge.
It just seemed a little odd. Like, why bother going up and over when you can just walk around it?
So she wrote into Bubbler Talk looking for answers. And we found out there's a lot more than meets the eye.
Buju, Ziguenodinens, Indigenous Kaz, Migizien Dodem, Odawa Zayaganing, Ojibwe Anishinaabe Kwe Indao, Menomini Zayaganing Indojaba. Nice to meet you.
Javon Marks is Communications and Marketing Director for the Indian Community School. She's Eagle Clan and a lineal descendant of the Lakota Ray Band of Lake Superior Chippewa. Here's the short answer about the bridge.
This bridge was a part of the original Coast Guard station. This is what remains.
From 1916 to 1969, the federal government operated a Coast Guard station here in McKinley Park. In late 1969, the Coast Guard moved to Bayview, abandoning the McKinley Park building. That's when Milwaukee's chapter of the American Indian Movement, or AIM, stepped in. It's a grassroots movement that advocates for Native self-determination. It was a time of profound social change. People like Herb Paulus were rising up against inequities. Paulus was Oneida and a Milwaukee AIM leader. On August 14, 1971, AIM tore the plywood barricades off the abandoned Coast Guard station at McKinley Park and started occupying it.
We want to highlight the drastic need of our people.
That's Paulus in an interview with TMJ4 News at the time.
There are funding agencies, government, state, etc., that have monies to help and are helping other people, but they've neglected us, the first Americans.
In a 2021 interview with WUWM, commemorating the 50th anniversary of the Coast Guard station occupation, Paulus's wife, Dorothy Ninham, explained what AIM was working towards.
You have to remember that a lot of our people were removed from reservations and put into the urban settings and promised housing and employment and education, and a lot of that never happened. You know, some of these people ended up in worse conditions than they were on the reservations, you know, living in poverty and some of them being homeless and with, you know, like jobs that couldn't support a family. So it was really a tough time. It was tough for us, but we had to stand our ground.
Paulus has since passed away. But as he and AIM occupied the Coast Guard building, they used the Treaty of Laramie to negotiate with the Nixon administration. Like other treaties, it says that federal government lands are held in trust and that if the government abandons a space, it should go back to its original caretakers.
Siobhan Mark says AIM was ready to defend its right to use the property.
There was even preparations for a armed standoff if necessary.
She says, according to Paulus, the government even considered sending in the Marines to take control of the building.
Fortunately, none of that happened. We were able to negotiate an agreement that would allow AIM to remain on the property and for the Indian Community School to bring their children and teachings here.
The Coast Guard Station became the Indian Community School's third home. It had previously been in a founding mother's home, then moved to a church basement. The school was located in the Coast Guard building until 1980, along with a culturally based alcohol treatment initiative. Then, after negotiations with the city and county, it moved to the Bartlett Avenue School building, then the Concordia College property near State Street. Mark says that both these places, including the Concordia campus, were in disrepair.
And it wasn't an easy place to be able to educate children. Their lunch was in another building from where they were being schooled. So if it was winter, they had put on their boots, hats, coats, mittens, you know, and be transported over there so they could eat lunch. And then they had to put their boots and hats and mittens and gloves on and go back to where they were being schooled.
Also, the school relied on federal grant funding, which was sometimes unreliable. It closed for a few years in 1983. That's around the same time that the Forest County Potawatomi, a small, impoverished tribe in northern Wisconsin, started bingo operations. Then the school came up with an idea.
In the mid-1980s, the Indian Community School was looking for a tribal partner to take land into trust. And it is my understanding that they approached every tribe in the state of Wisconsin. And the only tribe that said that they would be interested was the Forest County Potawatomi.
That's Jeff Crawford, a member of the Forest County Potawatomi and the tribe's attorney general. He explains the tribe's interest.
Although the reservation is located in northern Wisconsin, our historic treaty and occupation area is from Chicago all the way up to Door County. And so, in other words, all of Milwaukee, Kenosha, Racine, this entire southeastern Wisconsin was Potawatomi Treaty territory. For that reason, we were most interested in getting lands back in the Milwaukee area. And so that was a successful application in part because we had those historical connections to this very campus.
Part of the land the school acquired is a 7.5-acre property on Canal Street in the Menominee Valley. After a few years of negotiating with the city and county, the Forest County Potawatomi began operating a bingo hall there in 1991. It's now the Potawatomi Casino and Hotel, the first off-reservation casino in the country. And it's led to financial stability for both the Potawatomi and the Indian Community School.
From that point forward, there was a steady stream of revenue for the Potawatomi and for the Indian Community School. And so that was the beginnings of the relationship to how we got here today.
ICS was able to purchase the 178 acres on which the school is currently located. Here's Siobhan Marks.
And we are what we consider our forever home out in Franklin.
On a late spring day, students sit eating lunch inside the Indian Community School. It's a magnificent building that connects the outside natural world with the inside. Rain drips outside today, connecting Mother Nature with the natural materials the school is made of, including copper, wood, marble, and ancient stone. Many rooms have floor-to-ceiling windows, which capture views of the surrounding lush green gardens and pathways. There's intention in the way everything is built. About 360 kids attend school here. They learn a traditional K-4 through 8th grade curriculum. But the school is also bringing forward native languages, culture, and ways so the children learn about who they are and where they came from. So it turns out that the Bridge to Nowhere on Milwaukee's lakefront is a piece of the story that led to the present-day Indian Community School, which serves urban Milwaukee's American Indian population. You wouldn't know the deep history of this place where the bridge stands simply by looking at it. But why did they keep the bridge here? After the American Indian Movement left the McKinley Park Coast Guard Station in 1980, historian John Gerda says the building sat empty. The property suffered a serious fire in 1988, but Gerda says preservationists still look to it as a rare example of a prairie-style public building. And there were some ideas to make use of the space for a different purpose.
I think there were proposals for the Great Lakes Museum in there, and the location's pretty ideal, you know, just where the lake is right there. And there was, until the Potawatomi began to work on the cultural center over on the Concordia campus, there were plans for an Indian cultural center and plans for a restaurant as well. And I think some of those moved forward conceptually, but financing was difficult and rehab was difficult. You know, so none became realities, obviously.
The county finally tore down the former Coast Guard station in 2008, but the bridge remains. There's no plaque or historical marker at this place commemorating the American Indian Movement in Milwaukee. Here's Siobhan Marks again.
And I think it's important to note that this is the largest concentration of Native Americans in the entire state of Wisconsin, actually reside right here in Milwaukee, and we have a rich, vibrant Native community and have had for many years. That said, we are less than 2% of the overall population. So it is difficult to be seen, difficult to be remembered, unless someone actually takes that time to document that this is the original caretakers, this role in this part of history.
Mark says Milwaukee didn't start with its city charter and the electing of its first city council. Milwaukee began 40 or 50,000 years before that, with the original caretakers of the land. In a way, this bridge is a connector to that past and the future generations that honor it.
What have you always wanted to know about the Milwaukee area? Visit wuwm.com/bubblertalk to submit your question.
We'll take one more break and then meet a local home repair TikToker known as the Trans Handy Man. Keep listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. TikTok is a place that many people go for useful information. There are videos on everything from crafting and recipes to gardening and home repair. That's where Mercury Stardust comes in. The Wisconsin TikToker is known as the Trans Handy Ma'am, and her platform helps people learn how to fix up their homes and highlights issues important to the trans community. Stardust released a book called Safe and Sound, a renter-friendly guide to home repair in 2023. That's when she spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers.
I am someone who has watched your TikToks a number of times. Why did you first decide to start doing TikToks, get into this space?
Well, I was a burlesque dancer here in tropical Madison, Wisconsin, and a friend of mine said, hey, you should do TikToks to promote your show that's online. And I said, no one's going to watch that. And, you know, I got on TikTok for like a few weeks and I was just doing little fun videos. And one day someone posted a video where they needed help with a ratchet strap and they were getting made fun of in the comments. So all I did was post a video in response, trying to help them in a way that I would have wanted someone to help me when I was younger. And it really seemed to resonate with people. And I really enjoyed helping one person. So I kept on doing it, and then it just kept on going.
Most people who do this work are men. What has it been like for you working in this space as a handy person, especially as someone who has transitioned?
It sometimes can be a little bit of an uphill battle, right? Like when I'm in a room, more times than not, there's probably more men in that room than any other, you know, category of people. And it can be a little difficult sometimes to get a word in edgewise. But what has always really helped me is just staying true to who I am. I'm not there to necessarily impress anybody. I'm just there to be who I am. And I know that I'm really good at my job and I know I'm really knowledgeable, and that's always really helped me get through those moments. But yeah, it has been difficult at times.
Have there been any obstacles that surprised you?
I think when I came out a few years ago and people at the property company that I worked at, everyone was pretty cool with it. But when I would go into tenants' homes, sometimes tenants would not want to have me come in. Sometimes they would say, I don't want it to come into my home, and say some derogatory terms at me. Those have been difficult. And I think I knew that going in, that was always a chance that could happen. But I didn't realize to what extent people's bigotry would prevent them from seeing that all I want to do is help people and there's no agenda attached to it.
Sure. Now, it seems like your TikTok space is a pretty open and welcoming space, but in your work on the day-to-day, would you say that normally people are pretty cool, or are people kind of terrible?
Well, the good thing about being on TikTok now is anyone who works with me, anyone who seeks me out, they know exactly who I am and they know what I stand for. So I don't really work with or work around people who might have bigoted views about trans people. People seek me out, and because I am a trans person in this field, in a lot of ways, I'm kind of like, I'm like their favorite thing to reach out to, right? Like I'm doing quite well because I'm so different in the industry, and because I think differently and I educate differently and I do things ultimately not like what the status quo is. People seek out my knowledge rather than just happen to find it.
I mean, that makes me think of the first time I saw your TikTok, I went, this is a woman from Wisconsin. You don't get that accent from anywhere else. I don't know how big TikTok is in the state. I assume it's like anywhere else. Do you find you have this new celebrity status here?
You know, I want to say no, but it's a little overwhelming sometimes, you know, depending on where I am in the state. Like, the people who are on TikTok, it's overwhelmingly queer people who follow me. But when people recognize me, by the very nature of the beast, they're typically people who are, you know, they're an up and up. They're cool with the trans community and the LGBTQIA community. So I don't get too nervous. But every once in a while, I'll be at Home Depot or I'll be, you know, at Menards, and someone will scream across the aisle, "The trans handyman!" And I get a little nervous. To say the least, you know, being recognized so openly and loudly as a trans person in public can sometimes be nerve-wracking. But it's been a real wonderful thing. People tell me their stories about how I help them all the time, and that's just so wonderful. And what a privilege to have to help so many people.
I mean, one of the things that is really interesting about your content, but also, of course, your new book, you focus on a group that most of us have found ourselves a part of at one point or another, renters. What made you want to focus on the needs of renters versus homeowners?
Well, my ideology when it comes to activism has always been linked to intersectionality. And in intersectionality, we believe very firmly in order to help one marginalized group of people, you have to help the people who are the most vulnerable. So we often talk about the Black trans community being the community we want to help the most. Take that same type of logic and you put that into the homeowner space and you put that into a DIY space. What that end up becomes, it becomes renters. Because if you can help a renter, you can typically, sometimes, most of the time, help a homeowner. Most homeowners have been renters in their life, but most renters will never be a homeowner. And I think that that is a really important distinction. And the reason why I focus so strongly on renters, if I can help them, I can help a lot of people. If I only focus on homeowners, I'm missing an entire group of people that might need my help the most.
As you look at your own experiences, do you have advice for other women, other trans women who are interested in handiwork but leery of being in a space that has been generally dominated by men?
This space is filled with jobs where we work alone most of the time. As a maintenance technician, I didn't have to work with a lot of people all the time. It's a great job to be an individual, to rely on your own skills, to help people directly. There are opportunities and chances when we will be working with people who probably don't have our best interests in mind and view us not favorably. But the reality is this, our skill far exceeds people's expectations almost all the time, because we often have to be. Women, trans people, LGBTQIA people in the field typically have to be extremely good to get anywhere in this industry. And that often means that we impress people around us. So don't allow other people's perception of you to be your reality.
All right. Well, Mercury, thank you so much for speaking with me today about your work.
Thank you, Joy, for having me.
Mercury Stardust is a Madison-based TikToker known as the Trans Handy Ma'am. She spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers in 2023. And that's Lake Effect for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Joy Powers, Sam Woods, and X-Grid Nunez join me in producing Lake Effect each week with help from Rob Larry and Graham Thomas. Becky Mortensen is our executive producer. Emily Files helps edit the show. We also heard from Mayan Silver, Jimmy Gutierrez, and Maria Peralta Arellano from the WUWM News Team this week. Jason Reavy is our studio engineer. Michelle Maternowski is our digital manager. Valeria Navarro-Viegas is our digital editor. Trapper Shep wrote our theme music. If you've missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, simply download the Lake Effect podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Join us again on Monday at noon for a conversation with former Wisconsin Governor Marty Schreiber about his book on coping and caring for a partner with Alzheimer's. Thank you so much for joining us today, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.